J1. The Seven Synonymous Terms for God. Science and Health, 465-10. Number 1A.
Basically, there are two questions that each one of us must sooner or later ask. And I know we have asked them perhaps many times to ourselves. And these questions are two. One, what is reality? And two, how do I become one with this reality? Therefore, we ask the question, what is reality? And we see that this search for truth, this search for what is reality, began, as we know, about 500 BC. And this search has been mainly in the lines then of religion and philosophy, or in the sciences. Now, in answering this question, what is reality? It's actually very important that we take, therefore, a comprehensive view of the world today. And I often feel that when we begin these classes on science, that it is so important for us to get a tone of where the world is, and therefore we can see where we are. And recently, I read quite an interesting book from the field of psychology, and it's called Man's Search for Meaning, An Introduction to Logotherapy by Viktor E. Frankl. Now, this Dr. Frankl is at present, he's on the medical faculty at the University of Vienna, and he's the professor of psychiatry there, and also a professor of neurology. And amongst other positions, he also holds, it says on the back of the book, that he's president of the Austrian Medical Society for Psychotherapy. Now, again, the title of his book is Man's Search for Meaning, An Introduction to Logotherapy. Now, actually, it's quite an exciting book to read. You begin to see that Dr. Frankl employs this term logotherapy as a name for his theory on life. He actually coined this word logotherapy, and he combines the term logo with therapy. And logo, or logos, he has coming from the Greek root word, which means meaning. To him, logo, or logos, comes from the Greek word that denotes meaning. And so, in a way, actually, we could call this meaning therapy. But this logotherapy is actually Dr. Frankl's own version of what is called a modern existential analysis. And so we can ask ourselves then, what is modern existential analysis? And as it's related in this book, it mentions that existential, the word existential, may be used in three ways. And it's used in these three ways to refer to one, existence itself, two, the meaning of existence, and three, the striving to find a concrete meaning in personal existence, which in other words is just to say the will to meaning. Now, actually underlining this term existential, we see that this modern existential analysis then in a way deals with those two basic fundamental questions that we must ask. And those two questions is, what is reality? And according to this modern existential analysis, then the same question would be, what is existence itself, or what is the meaning of existence? Or the other big question we asked is, and we're all interested in, not only what is reality, we want to know what is reality, but above all, we want to know, how do I become one with this reality? I mean, it's fine to know what reality is, but we're always, where's the I, what's the me, what am I going to do with the I, me, me? So we say, the next big question is, how do I become one with this reality? And according to this view of modern existential analysis, they would form the question this way. How do I strive to find a concrete meaning in personal existence? So you see, in this modern existential analysis that Frankl is putting forth, they're asking those same two basic questions. What is existence, and how do I strive to become one with this existence? Now, actually, in the field of psychology, this logotherapy is unique. And as I mentioned, this is Dr. Frankl's own version. It's his own version of existential analysis. But logotherapy is unique to the field of psychology and to psychotherapy, and it's actually called the Third Viennese School of Psychotherapy. Now, many of you may know that the First Viennese School of Psychotherapy was under the direction of Freud, and the Second School of Viennese Psychotherapy was under the direction of Adler, and the Third School of Viennese Psychotherapy is now under the direction of Frankl. Now, this is what's important to see here. Frankl's logotherapy stresses that the primary driving force in man's life is his will to meaning. He says the primary driving force in man's life is his will for meaning. Now, this is in contrast to the Freudian psychotherapy, which you hear so much about Freud, and it's in contrast to the Adlerian psychotherapy. What is it? What's the contrast? What's the difference? Frankl says man's basic drive is a will to meaning. Freud stresses that man's primary drive is the will to pleasure. Adler stresses that man's primary drive is the will to power. So in these three Viennese schools of psychotherapy, we have three basic driving forces that are put forth that impel man forward. Freud, the will to pleasure. Adler, the will to power. And Frankl, the will to meaning. Now, as I mentioned, logotherapy, meaning therapy, is Frankl's own unique version of modern existential analysis. Now, this differs greatly, again, than the leading existentialists. And how? The leading existentialists believe today that man invents himself. In other words, it's man who invents the meaning to life. And it's man who designs what he essentially should be. Or it's man who designs what he essentially is. But Frankl says no. And I'd just like to make a little quote here, what Frankl says. The meaning of our existence is not invented by ourselves, but rather detected. So Frankl says no to the existentialists. He says, man doesn't invent the meaning of life himself, but he must detect the meaning of life. Therefore, you can see that Frankl says that there exists in life meaning per se, and it is up to man to search for that meaning. Man doesn't invent it, he searches for it. And therefore, you can have as a difference between Frankl's modern existential analysis and the other existentialists. And also as a side remark, I think that it's very important to mention here that Frankl has in his teaching something which is called an existential vacuum. Remember, we have together talked about how Future Shock and Toffler mentioned that the disease of the coming century is future shock and man's inability to cope with the future because there's so much change coming along. Man cannot cope. He experiences consciousness lag and he experiences, therefore, a disease called future shock. Well, Frankl's disease of the future is called an existential vacuum. Now, this existential vacuum is actually a situation in which a person feels that his life is totally meaningless. And how many people do we know that feel, well, you know, that my life is totally meaningless? And therefore, it's just a person who gets up each morning and just says, oh, you know, man, how am I going to make it through the day? You know, like there's no meaning to my life. And every day my life gets less and less meaningful. And he experiences, therefore, just a total inner emptiness. And it's a total void within themselves. In other words, an existential vacuum. Now, actually, this existential vacuum manifests itself Frankl says, in a state of boredom. And this is really beautiful, because I think this perhaps is something that is happening today. And I'd like to read just a few paragraphs from this book to set his tone of what an existential vacuum actually means. He says, "This existential vacuum manifests itself mainly in a state of boredom." Now, we can understand Schopenhauer when he said that mankind was apparently doomed to vacillate eternally between two extremes of distress and boredom. In actual fact, boredom is now causing and certainly bringing to psychiatrists more problems to solve than distress. Let us think, for instance, of the Sunday neurosis, the kind of depression which afflicts people who become aware of the lack of content in their lives, when the rush of the busy week is over and the void within themselves becomes manifest. Not a few cases of suicide can be traced back to this existential vacuum. Such widespread phenomena as alcoholism and juvenile delinquency are not understandable unless we recognize the existential vacuum underlying them. This is also true of the crisis of pensioners and aging people. Moreover, there are various masks and guises under which the existential vacuum appears. Sometimes the frustrated will to meaning is vicariously compensated for by a will to power, including the most primitive form of the will to power, the will to money. In other cases, the place of frustrated will to meaning is taken by the will to pleasure. So we see here the existential vacuum, and how Frankl therefore goes on in his book to show how they therefore work with the people in order to search for a meaning in their life. So actually what Frankl is seeing is a great step forward, I feel, in the field of psychology, in the field of psychotherapy. It's a great step forward to have man search for a will to meaning, then a will to pleasure, or a will to power. And it's also, I think, Frankl is helping mankind in a big way. But I always like where the buts come in, or the howevers, because we begin to see that there's a big break now that comes between the teaching of Frankl and logotherapy and the teachings of psychotherapy with the teachings of the science of Christian Science. And I think we must see what this big break is. And I think obviously enough to many of us, we know therefore that Frankl works within the human system of reference. And when one reads Frankl's book, you just actually become just very disappointed. He has stated a beautiful theory, and when he actually comes to the practical application of this theory in his everyday sessions when he's working with the patients, you become very disappointed in the application of it, because you feel that his theory outstrips his performance. Because when they're helping people, you feel that all that happens is that the human opinion of the patient is therefore just being transferred or exchanged for the human opinion of the doctor. And one feels that is the human opinion of the patient actually maybe was better than the human opinion of the doctor. And we just continue to work within the realm of human opinions. So actually we begin to see that in Frankl's search for meaning and their actual application of this theory in practical life falls short, because they actually don't touch the meaning of life per se. This, though, I think is important too. We begin to see, though, that the world begins to ask right questions. They begin to search for what is reality, what is existence, how can I become one with this existence? And when they ask right questions, we know that sooner or later they'll bring forth the right answers. Now, in this work that we're doing with the study of Christian Science, we know that we also ask those two questions: what is reality, and how do I become one with this reality? However, in our study, in the science of Christian Science, we begin to see that reality is something which is totally apart from the human system of reference. And it is so apart that we have to see what that human system of reference is. And as we know, this human system of reference is based on, therefore, the human mind. And we have seen that this human mind reasons in a two-valued logic. And it is a two-valued logic which reasons in opposites. Therefore, it reasons in the opposites of spirit and matter, and the opposites of soul and body, and the opposites of good and evil, and the opposites of life and death. And because it reasons in these opposites, we see that it follows these certain lines. This is the reality that exists for the human system of reference and for the human mind. The reality that exists for this human mind is that there's a world of ignorance, there's a world of human creators, there's a world of animal magnetism, mesmerism, hypnotism, occultism, necromancy, astrology. There's a world of matter and flesh. There's wars, there's human birth, there's chaos, there's unreality. There's the five physical senses that tell us what the world's about. There's sin, there's sorrow, there's loss. There's human personalities, human desires and theories, disharmony, disobedience, hypocrisy, disloyalty, false education. We see that there's material life, mortal life, organic life, time and space, life and death. We see that we have false remedies, all sorts of errors. We have the human conscious, subconscious, and unconscious. We experience fear, hate, envy, jealousy, imperfection, unfulfillment, divorce, ugliness, strife, enemies, accusers, just a lack of purpose, apathy. This is what the human system of reference brings. And then, just in a nutshell, we have the human system of reference, again, based on a two-valued logic. Its basis premise is that it always goes out from imperfection. And this is, it's just, one just cannot state this enough to think of how often we get up in the morning and we immediately go out from imperfection, that, you know, things just are not going to go right, such and such is going to happen. It is just natural with us. And therefore, this human system of reference, therefore, that reasons with a two-valued logic and goes out from imperfection, rests, therefore, on those basic points, and I mention them again, of the human mind, matter, the five physical senses, the personal theories, time and space, the human conscious, subconscious, and unconscious, and imperfection. So, in our study of the science of Christian Science, we begin to see that those two big questions, what is reality and how can I become one with this reality, cannot be answered according to that human system of reference. And we begin to see that reality is something that exists totally apart from that system of reference. And in order to understand reality, we have to think totally new. And here is something I think which comes a very important point. And it's that this new system of reference is based on those capitalized terms as found in Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures by Mary Baker Eddy. Now the crucial point is, because those capitalized terms are found in Science and Health, does this mean that the science of Christian Science is just some insignificant hobby of a few religious people? I mean, is it a hobby of just those of us here? I mean, do we feel like we want to now spend a few evenings together just going over some basic fundamentals of something that amounts to be just a hobby, just a personal fun game, you know, so we have nothing else to do on Friday evenings, we'll come and have some fun, you know. The important point is that we feel that the study of the science of Christian Science is actually a study of reality itself. Therefore, because it's a study of reality itself, it can answer the question, what is reality? Now, we know that what Mary Baker Eddy presented to the world as Christian Science has been accepted by the world as a religion. It's just very well accepted as a religion. You say, well, you know, that Christian Science, oh, yes, sure, that's, you know, I know, it's a religion. And we say, yes, that's true. It is true. What Mary Baker Eddy presented is in direct line with the revelation that appears in the Bible. But what the world has not seen is that what Mary Baker Eddy has presented is a science, and that it actually is the science and lays the foundation for the science of being, and it actually lays a foundation for the sciences of all sciences. Therefore, it's interesting to see that Mrs. Eddy calls her presentation in Science and Health a scientific revelation, meaning that what she presented is in line with direct revelation, but it's based on scientific reasoning. I also think that it's important here for us to see that Mary Baker Eddy, I just feel that it isn't seen enough, because I feel that she was a scientist of the highest excellence. And actually, she was a scientist in the same caliber as Einstein. And we know that how Einstein is a physical scientist who presented to the world that really beautiful formula of E equals MC squared. And I think it's Buckminster Fuller who said that it's probably one of the most beautiful poems that has ever been written. But this formula of E equals MC squared describes reality as being within a four-dimensional space-time continuum. And this is what we must remember, that E equals MC squared describes reality as being within a four-dimensional space-time continuum. Now, Mary Baker Eddy was a divine scientist, and she actually presented to a world a formula which is greater than E equals MC squared, and that's saying quite a bit. Her formula is based on 15 root notions. And what we must see is that these 15 root notions take man totally out of a four-dimensional space-time continuum, because her formula exists in reality, which is free of time and space. And if one can ever get the feeling and know how reality, which is in the realm of idea, is free of time and space, we overcome the whole third dimension and fourth dimensional space-time continuum belief. So what we see then, that Mrs. Eddy was actually a higher and greater scientist than Einstein. She was a divine scientist. And I feel that it's now just a question of when will the world free itself from this limited four-dimensional space-time continuum and really come into a reality which is free of time and space. Therefore, I feel that we should not feel what we're doing here is just an insignificant hobby, that it is sectarian, it belongs to just a little group of Christian scientists, because actually what we're studying is the science of being. And this science of being, in its total purity, cannot be found in the world today. And I may say that I've read many, many books from physicists, psychologists, philosophy, what have you. They're beginning, as we saw with Frankl, to ask right questions. And they're asking beautiful questions. They're asking, what is the science of wholeness? What is the science of being? What is reality? How can I become one with this reality? They're asking right questions. But their theory outstrips performance. When you get down into practical application, one becomes disappointed. So therefore, I feel that what Mrs. Eddy presented as the science of being is the science of being in its pure, purest form. And I feel, therefore, that it's just a little while before the world catches up. In a way, we can say that we can just sit back and wait for the world to catch up. Because what we are studying is actually a science which is in the future, which the world will comprehend. The science of ideas, which are free of time and space. So this is actually something I wanted to mention, and also wanted to say that this is why it makes me happy to dedicate my life to the study of the science of Christian Science. And may you believe that it takes complete patience, because you feel like, I've got to read all these books that are coming out. They're exciting, they're new, the people are presenting exciting things, and to sit back and say, whoa, wait, just a minute. I want to see that science of Christian Science in its purity. Therefore, I have to not to a degree, read everything that comes out. I have to dedicate myself to something. And it's the science of Christian Science because I feel that there is the basic root notions of being. Now, even though the terminology will change in the future, who knows what the terminology will be? It may be different. But this doesn't matter because the basic facts which are presented are eternal. Also, just for some of those who are new here tonight, I also want to emphasize, because it comes up quite often, I want to mention that this class, therefore, will be in the direct scientific line with the teachings of Mary Baker Eddy, John Dorley, and Dr. Max Kapler. Therefore, I want to stress that anything that I say will not be based on any personal theory that I may have about reality or any ism or ology or new ism or ology that may be coming out in the world. And I think this is the beauty of science itself. Because science, as we know, is knowledge which is reduced to law and embodied in a system, we therefore that see because science comes in laws, in orders, in rules, in systems, we see that therefore, this, by adhering to these certain laws, we absolutely free ourselves from any personal interpretation. Okay, that's basically what I wanted to mention as a type of an introductory remark. And I'd like to have you turn to the illustrative material that you have before you. New system of reference, which is actually the divine system of reference. And here we see with this divine system of reference that it is based on 15 root notions. This is the formula, so to speak, of 15 root notions. And we see under the heading there of the synonyms for God that here are the seven basic elements presented, which are, of course, mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. Then we see there the operation, the fourfold operation of the Word, Christ, Christianity, and science. And then the four levels of spiritual consciousness of science itself, divine science, absolute Christian science, and Christian science.